Welcome for Computer Graphics. We are currently looking into lighting computations. That is, we now don't compute colors on objects from attributes or something like that, where colors are directly given, but we make really something like a very simple light computation. That means given are some light sources in our scene, typically one point light source or maybe also a parallel light source, and then described by material parameters, we have a material model that describes how this light from this light source is reflected towards the viewer, and this gives us a shading on the object, and the impression that we see an object as we know it from the real physical world that is illuminated by lights. And we were looking at probably most basic lighting model, the Phong lighting model, which is not very physical based, but it works good for different sorts of objects, mainly those that look like plastic, but it's a kind of standard in computer graphics and very widely used. And it has three components: ambient light, which is just a constant that models all the indirect light in a scene that cannot be computed by this very simple lighting model otherwise. So it's a kind of constant offset so that we can also see the dark side of objects, for instance, that otherwise would be completely black. Then we have a diffuse part and a specular part. And the diffuse part is physically based. And we see an example here. So the diffuse part only depends on the angle between the light source and the normal. And it is just controlled by the cosine of the angle between the two. And this cosine can be computed by the scalar product between N and L if both are normalized vectors. Yeah, so that one is very simple to compute. It's independent of the view direction. So it's the same from whatever direction we look at the object. And if we only use that diffuse term, we get some shading, but the objects look very soft, yeah? And they have a very, very special look. But it's the first simple shading model to use diffuse. And later on, we were also looking at specular reflection. And the idea of specular reflection is that the surface is much more mirror-like, but it has some roughness, some microscopic roughness, which we don't see at first sight, or if we look at it macroscopically, but microscopically, it has some structure. And so it doesn't have a perfect reflection, but a blurred reflection. And this blurriness is computed in the way that for every point light source, we compute the reflection vector, the perfect reflection, and then, like here, and then for a particular view direction, we measure how far away are we from the perfect reflection direction. And so the model is that in the perfect reflection direction, we have a kind of maximum brightness. And the further we get away from this maximum reflection direction, then the reflection is reduced. And this is modeled in the way that we measure the cosine between R and V. V is the direction to the camera. Yeah, and R is this perfect reflection. We measure this angle or compute this angle and its cosine. This cosine is 1 if we are perfectly in the reflection direction, and it falls to 0 the further we get away. So that's exactly what we want, but normally we want the fall off to be faster. So we also take such an exponent, n, and with this exponent, we get something like we can see here. Yeah, so for instance, this green curve describes a fall off for an exponent of 10. Yeah, and this is a realistic value that we normally have. So that says in perfect reflection direction here, we have maximum reflection, and the further we get away, it falls off. Yeah, it almost looks like such a Gaussian curve, but in fact, it's just a cosine to the nth. And N is a material parameter, and with that one, we can control, how glossy that surface is. Yeah, the larger N, the smaller this reflection peak is. Yeah, and thus the more glossy it is. Here we can see such examples. So for an exponent of 50, we get something like this. The exponent 10 here gives this here. You see here the highlight is just larger than here. Yeah, and for, I mean, shiny, this exponent setting it to zero doesn't make sense. Yeah, but yeah, values beyond 5 usually are useful. Okay, so that's a very simple model. In particular, the specular part really has no physical meaning. It is just kind of fast way to compute something that looks reasonable, but with no physical foundation. And in particular, there's one thing that you can also already realize here. These images only differ by the exponent. And if you look at this reflection and at this reflection, obviously here, much more light is reflected than is here. Yeah, just because this bell is wider. Yeah. And in terms of energy conservation, that doesn't really make sense. Yeah, because the larger you make n, this glossy parameter, the less light is reflected. Yeah, the less energy is reflected. And it would make sense to have a model where you can, yeah, that's always conserving energy. Yeah, but you can make the highlight smaller, but at the same time have to make the reflection brighter. Yeah, so in order to conserve energy. Okay, this is not the matter here for this very simple way, for this very simple model. If we go to more physically based models, then these things will play a role, and we will come back to this also. Yeah, even today in the next model that we are looking at. Okay, so here we see curves, how this looks like. Yeah, so we have a diffuse part. That's always this this hemisphere. Yeah, so here we see the reflection in any direction depending on different incident angles. Yeah, so the more grazing angles we have, the smaller the diffuse reflection, and the specular reflection is here this lobe around the main reflection direction. And if we sum up these two, we get these shapes here. Okay. Good. So this is where we've been last time. And now there is a simple variant of that model that we will use, that is quite often used. And so in this variant, the idea is the following. Instead of measuring the angle between our reflection direction and V, yeah, so this is what we measure, this angle here for the normal Phong model. Instead of measuring that angle, we can do the following. We can say, okay, I look at the surface from direction V. Light comes from L. What would be the normal that leads to a total, yeah, perfect reflection? So we measure the half angle H, or we compute the half vector between L and V. Yeah, and this is this H. That can be computed very simply. Yeah, it's just the average of L and V. Yeah, just the vector half between the two. And now the closer this H is to the real normal, yeah, the closer we are to the perfect reflection, obviously. Yeah. So instead of measuring this angle, we measure this angle between N and H. And in the coplanar case, like here, this angle will always be exactly half the angle of this angle. Yeah, that can be geometrically, that can be quickly shown. Yeah, so the angle is in general smaller. In general, it's only half the angle of that one. But in several cases, it can be computed easier. It's easier to compute that. And what we can do is that we just take another a variant of the Phong model, and we say instead of the cosine of this angle, we take the cosine of this angle, and this is the scalar product of N and H, and otherwise everything is the same, because the angle is usually generally smaller. Yeah, we get a little bit sharper highlights, so we need can take a little bit smaller exponents, but otherwise it's very similar. In, as I said, if all are coplanar, then these angles are directly related with this formula. If they are not coplanar, then the relation is a little bit more difficult, but in general, it leads to very similar results. And this is called the halfway optimization. In very old times, when performance really was much more an issue even than today, the idea often was that for many scenes, we could say, okay, we assume L is constant. That means we take a parallel light source, then L is constant. And for the entire scene, we also assume that V is constant. This is in general not the case, but we can just say we take the average view direction. As an approximation, and then we can pre-compute H. And then the entire lighting model is just, again, a very simple scalar product. This constant H multiplied with a current normal. And that was very efficient to compute. We need no reflection vectors and all that stuff. And that was a very, very simple optimization. But nevertheless, we will see also in the next model that this halfway vector here is a very good means to also compute how far are we away from the perfect reflection direction. And that's quite often used. Okay, good. So, up to now, we were only looking at local points. We were only looking at a point on a surface and light coming from some direction and a viewer looking at that point from some direction. But we did not, and we always said we have something like an intensity of the light source at this point, and this is modulated by our model. But we ignored how far away is the light source. And obviously that also has impact. If I take a light and I illuminate something 10 meters away, obviously much less light will arrive than if it's close. So we also have to think about how can we compute the incident light from a light source at some point. And how is that related in particular to the distance? And that's very simple. Physics says that the incident light at some point is the excitant light of that light source over the distance squared. So in twice the distance, we only have 1/4 of the incident light. That's a very normal way how such spherical waves behave. That would mean in all our formulas here, if we have a point light source here, the incident light from light source I is just the intensity of that light source over the squared distance to that light source. So when we compute the light vector, we normalize that light vector anyhow, so we know its length, and then we divide its incident intensity by the squared distance. So that works, but in practice, even if it's physically correct, these light sources often look, or this attenuation looks too extreme. You get very, if you have a light source close to a wall or something like that, you get a very bright spot here that very quickly falls off, and it just looks unnatural for many reasons. So missing indirect light, missing tone mapping, we will come back to that, and all that stuff. So a practical approach was to say, okay, obviously, quadratic fall off doesn't look good. So we make it more general. And the typical model is to say that the fall off is modeled with such a polynomial. So in the denominator, we have a quadratic polynomial with coefficients C0, C1, and C2. We can choose all these parameters. And by this, we can model a light source that only has a linear fall off, which is from a physical point of view, nonsense, but can look good. And it gives the user more freedom to choose parameters so that for his or her particular scene, it looks good. Okay, but that's just a practical thing that we can choose this attenuation. Okay, so how can we try and do that all more physically based? as you've seen up to now, we have parameters like this coefficient, this exponent, yeah, that we choose until it looks right. Yeah, we choose the attenuation of light sources. Yeah, we twist parameters until we get the result we have. But wouldn't it make more sense to have a real physical lighting model so that we can say, okay, I have this real world surface, derive parameters for a model so that I can reproduce the look of this surface. Yeah, that would be a much more or much better approach. And there are many such light models, yeah, that try to measure the reflection behavior of surfaces and define a model for that. Some are very general, so they also include interreflection, subsurface scattering, scattering under the surface, interference, fluorescence, whatever. Yeah, all different lighting effects. I won't detail on that, but I would like to describe a model that is already pretty old, but that's essentially still the basics for most models that are still used today, even if they are physics-based. And that's the model that was originally defined by Torrance and Sparrow in 67 and later on for adapted for computer graphics by Cook and Torrance in 1982. And there's also a variant where also Jim Blinn was included. So then it's also Blinn, Cook, Torrance. Yeah, and there are several publications on that. But the core idea is always the following. We have a surface, and the surface has some roughness. Yeah. And due to this roughness, the reflection changes, of course. Yeah, but on a microscopic level, we still have perfect reflection at this microsurface. Yeah, and perfect reflection can be described rather easily. Yeah, or we will see there are complicated formulas, but it's understood how perfect reflection works. And then all these effects just come from the roughness of the surface and how rough it is. Yeah, and then we need to find a way to describe this roughness somehow. Yeah, so the major assumption is we have a macroscopic surface. This is the surface for which we have a model. Yeah, these are our triangles. But if we would take a microscope, there would be a small, tiny structure on that. We cannot see these little bumps. Yeah, they are all smaller than a pixel. So we just see that light is not perfectly reflected, that it's not a mirror, but there is some roughness. Yeah, it's like if you look at the ocean, yeah, from the beach, you can see the single waves, but if you go to an airplane, you cannot see the waves, but you still can see, yeah, if the sea is totally flat, it looks very different from if there are waves, yeah, because then the reflection looks different. Yeah, you cannot see the single waves from the airplane, but you can see the effect of these waves in the reflections. And so the model thus says that we have this microscopic surface, and in fact they don't really describe that as such a wave surface, but they define, or they say, there are microfacets. Yeah, so we have our surface, and in fact the surface consists of many little facets, yeah, and they all have varying normals. And in average, their normal is the normal of the macroscopic surface, yeah. But due to these surface roughness, the normals of these surfaces are distributed. And essentially, by somehow defining the distribution of these normals, yeah, the look of that surface is defined. And to describe the distribution of these normals, yeah, for now we assume that the surface is isotropic. That means normals are not only moving in one direction, but isotropically in all directions. Yeah, that's a typical assumption. That means, yeah, so we only have to somehow have to define how the normals are distributed by measuring the angle between the normal of the macroscopic surface and the normals of these microscopic surfaces, yeah, of these facets. Okay, and so altogether, the model will look like this. So we have three terms here in the denominator, D, F, and G. Then we have terms for normalization. I won't detail very much on these. So the scalar product between N and V and N and L ends up here in the denominator. But interesting are D, F, and G. And D is essentially the term that comes from the distribution from the normals. Yeah, so D will describe how do the normals vary. Yeah, this is the roughness of the surface. I will see how this is described in a minute. Yeah, then we have the Fresnel term. And that one is also interesting. This term is part of the description of perfect reflection at a surface. And here the point is the following, that on normal surfaces, normal. So let's say, for instance, water surface. Yeah, if you're standing at a pool, and you look at the surface, at the water surface, and if you look from a grazing angle, most of what you see comes from direct reflection, but also a part comes from refraction. Yeah, and in particular, if you're at a grazing angle, most light is reflected. I mean, for the light source, it comes the other direction. Yeah, so light from this angle is mostly reflected. But if you look here directly close to you, you will see the ground of the pool. So here, much more light is reflected and less is refracted. Yeah, so the ratio between reflected and refracted light depends on the angle. And this is described by the Fresnel term. There are formulas for that. Yeah, it's understood how that works. And this term also comes in here, because if we now reflect light at these microfacets, we also have to look at that term if we do it physically based. And then there's another term, G, which describes shadowing within that surface. And I will describe that if we have an image, because then it's easier to describe on a later slide. First of all, let's look at D. This is probably the most interesting term, because it describes the characteristics of that surface and it describes how these microfacets are scattered. And to describe these, we have lots of vectors. That's more like a glossar here, so that we see all these formulas. But the interesting part is always N and H. Yeah? So you remember H is this halfway vector that was used in the Blinn-Fong model. And exactly this is also taken here. Because now here the argument is the following. We have microfacets, and on these microfacets we have perfect reflection. So if I have light from direction L and I'm looking from direction V, then I get reflection in this direction if I have a microfacet that has exactly H as normal. So essentially, our model has to measure, has to compute H and then determine how likely is it that a microfacet has exactly this normal. So this is how with H, with this halfway vector, we can ease all these computations essentially, or describe that in a simple manner. This is essentially how this term D now also works. And here we see now a long version of the formula that we've seen before. And you see that the term D depends on the scalar product between H and N. I will show you possible shapes of D in a minute. That's exactly what I said. It depends on H, on the halfway angle. The Fresnel term depends on the cosine of the incident light. That's also what I told you. Here, this incident angle is different than here. So this controls the Fresnel term. And the geometric term depends on the incident light and the view direction. And again, as I said, I will show that in a minute. Okay, now, and how does that term D look like? So D is a function yeah, that depending on the cosine of this angle, depending on the cosine between halfway vector and normal, tells us how many, yeah, how big is the reflection in that direction. And essentially that is a curve, yeah, that tells us for an angle of zero, yeah, there's the cosine is one. For an angle of zero, we have in that case for that material, and this curve here now is a curve that describes a material, yeah. For an angle of zero, we have most facets, yeah. Most facets have the original or the likelihood that the orientation of a facet corresponds to the, or is the same as the main normal. Yeah, this is maximal. And the more away we get from this, yeah, the larger the angle becomes, larger angle meets smaller cosine, then this curve goes down. Yeah, so this is a material, yeah, that is very similar to this Phong material. Yeah, so we have a fall off, we have most reflection. If the normal corresponds to the main reflection direction, and the further we get away, the more it drops off. But of course, now here we are much more flexible in defining this curve, yeah, and we can also define things. Yeah, so this curve, so we can in general control the width of this. Yeah, so we can take something like this. This would be more glossy. This would be less glossy, but we could also define things like surfaces that have such a microscopic structure. So if you look at that, you see we only have facets with this direction and with this direction. Yeah, and essentially in this diagram, this would be something like this. Yeah. Then in the, if we take the normal of the macroscopic surface, we have no reflection at all. Yeah. But for these here, yeah, if this is n, yeah, so you see we have a peak for this angle. Yeah, so this would be the cosine of this angle here. Yeah, and that's a very general way to describe the distribution of the normals of microfacets and thus to describe arbitrary surfaces. Yeah. And yeah, this can be described by an arbitrary curve, yeah. So we can really write down or make a table with values for this curve. But normally, of course, models then are used to describe the shape of this curve with a handful of parameters. And one very often used model is to take a Gaussian distribution. Yeah, so we take a Gaussian to describe that curve. So that would probably be a distribution that comes from a Gaussian, or at least it looks like. And then we have the typical parameter of alpha, yeah, that controls just the width of that curve. Yeah, the center is always at one, the mean value, but we can control the width and then get a nice distribution. Or another variant is to take another distribution. Beckmann is used quite often, so you see it already gets more complicated, yeah, but it's just different models to describe such curves, and these models are different in what types of material can best be fit with these parameters. And there are several other distributions. I won't detail on that here. Okay, so that's number one, yeah, and with this term we can describe the roughness of our surface, yeah, in a very convenient way. Then we have the Fresnel term, and yeah, I told you what the idea is. So if we have a dielectric surface and we have a photon coming in from a certain direction, yeah, then the Fresnel term simply tells us how likely is it that this photon is reflected or refracted. And this depends on this angle. Yeah, if the photon comes here parallel to the normal, it's much more likely that it's just that it penetrates the surface, yeah, and continues through water, and much less is reflected. But if we are from a grazing angle, then it's just the other way around. Yeah, here much more light is reflected, and only very little light is refracted, or at some point even zero. And this is controlled by this term here. To make things a little bit more complicated, the Fresnel term does not only depend on the angle, but also on the polarization of light. This is a special property of light that we didn't look into yet and won't also for the rest of the lecture, that light is an electromagnetic wave, and it's an electric field and a magnetic field that are perpendicular to each other. And if we now say, okay, we look at the direction of the electrical field, then this is a vector that is parallel to the direction the light is transported. And this can be rotated. Yeah. And now the Fresnel term depends with that. And so you see here the two different terms, for parallelization that is then parallel to the surface and that is perpendicular to the surface that is hit. And for normal light, we just assume that light is not polarized, that this polarization direction is random, and then we can just average these two terms and get the real Fresnel term for unpolarized light. Yeah, but you see these formulas are already, require quite some computation. If we do that for every pixel, for every 2 million pixels, 60 times a second, that's definitely relevant whether this term is computed or not. So a very often used approximation of that term has been defined by Schlick for computer graphics purposes. And that's this much more simple term, much simpler term. And here, capital F0 and F0 are special Fresnel terms, I think, for perpendicular direction, and I'm not sure, but it's constants that can be computed depending on the optical density. That's something I forgot to mention. This Fresnel term also depends on the optical density of material. Yeah, you remember optical density also controls here refraction. Yeah, so if light goes from one optical density to another one, it is refracted. That's how glasses work. And how much it is refracted depends on the optical density. And that controls also this Fresnel term. That's these terms N1 and N2. That's the optical density of the outside and of the inside of the material. Okay, and with this simple approximation for computer graphics purposes, this is normally just fine. And here we have some numbers. So for common glass, for instance, if we look at a surface from a perpendicular direction, only 4% of the light is reflected, and that means 96% go through. That's why you can look through a window, but you also know the effect that if you look at the window from the side, at some point you see more reflection than you see inside. And at 80%, if you look at a window, it's already that 50% are reflection and do not come from the inside, just as an example. Okay, so that's the Fresnel term. And then finally, we have this a little bit strange term, G. One might say, please.
I have a question about the D term.
The
example you showed on the
Shouldn't
there be two peaks because there are...
Okay. It's a good question. The reason is that for now we make this isotropic assumption. That means if this is our main normal, the probability that you have this normal or that you have this normal are both the same. They just depend on this angle. But in fact, for that surface, this is no longer true because this angle is not contained. So to describe that, we would need something more complicated that measures the deviation in this direction and in this direction. And then we need two angles, and all this can be extended this way, but it makes things more complicated. And anisotropic materials are rather uncommon. So there are a few examples like silk as a side, or brushed metal, yeah, where you can see these little strips, yeah, so where the reflection is then not uniform in all directions. But that's rather uncommon. Okay? But if you have isotropies, if your material is isotropic, then you just have to measure this angle, and it's independent of the direction. But it's difficult to construct something like this geometrically. Would be a thing, something to think about. Okay. Oops. Good. So let's go to, where are we? Geometric term. The geometric term, in some sense, now kind of models everything that cannot be explained by the rest of the model. And in fact, there is still ongoing research how this term can be described best, and new models that try to better capture that one. The general idea is the following. So if we have a surface like this here, for instance, and we have a light source shining from here, then these facets here can generate a perfect reflection, yeah? But due to the structure of the surface, we won't see that because it's just occluded here by the next wave. Yeah, so in particular, if we look at a surface from grazing angles, we just see the tips of these waves here. And these have another normal distribution than if we look from here, because then we see all the facets. And the same is true for the light source. Yeah? If the light source comes from a grazing angle, it cannot reflect at these surfaces because they are shadowed. Yeah? So this self-shadowing in this microstructure somehow also has to be accounted for. And yeah, this is what happens in this geometric term. And as I said, there are several models and still ongoing new papers that found a new model to describe that better relates with real measurements of real surfaces. The typical way to describe it can be seen here. Yeah, so that we have, here scalar products between N and H, N and V, V and H. Yeah, and then apply this minimum function. It's not so important how that formula looks like. It's just important, yeah, to see where it comes from, and that somehow we also have to account for that. And as I said, there are different variants how to do so. Okay, so that's a more physically based model. And this microfacet model is still the state of the art in some sense, yeah, or it's just the way how this D term and the G term is described, yeah, can now vary. And there's much research going on that. The Fresnel term is physically explained, yeah, so that's clear, but D and G, these are the interesting components. Okay, good. So that was just a little peek into that we can do that also in a correct way and not only use the Phong model. So I need too much time. shading. Up to now, we only compute or learned how to compute the color at a particular point. If we know that surface point, if we know its normal light direction and the view direction, and we already spoke about shading. Shading is the process that we determine colors while rasterizing a triangle. Yeah? And the question is now, how can we include this lighting computation into that rasterization process? And yeah, flat shading is probably the most stupid way to do it. And here the idea is the following. Whenever we rasterize a triangle, yeah, we make a lighting computation, for instance, at the center of that triangle, and this color we use for the entire triangle. Yeah, so we do not make shading, we take a constant color per triangle, and this color comes from lighting. Yeah, And I mean, it is clear what will happen. So we get images like this, where we can clearly see these single facets of our object. So this is supposed to be a sphere, but due to that constancy, we can see the single facets. We can account for that by using smaller triangles, but that's counterproductive. That means we have more geometry, and that makes things slower. So definitely that's not the best idea, because it just doesn't look good. And the fact that it doesn't look good is even more pronounced due to the so-called Machband effect. And this is a well-known effect. So if you look at this pattern here, believe me that within each of these boxes, the color is constant. You can take a tool and look at the RGB values in these boxes. They are all constant, but normally, if I look at this one here, for instance, it definitely looks like this would be brighter and then gets darker here, right? Who doesn't see that? Okay. And that's a well-known effect. It's just that this contrast here, this step here from dark to bright, by human vision is sort of exaggerated, just to make details better visible. So if we have such a step here, such a step function, the perceived intensity here goes down, and here on the other side goes up. So this side we see brighter, and this side we see darker. And now with these facets, if we go back to these images, you can see that within all these facets, that they have constant brightness, but perceived, the brightness changes within these single squares or quadrilaterals. So it's even pronounced, this discontinuity. So that's something we should avoid, and we should try to get a smoother shading on our objects, without discontinuities. And the first idea you already learned about, that's Gouraud shading. And here the idea was that we define colors at the vertices, and then during rasterization interpolate these colors. And of course now what we can do is that we say, okay, I compute the color at the vertices of a triangle before rasterization, and then interpolate the resulting color. That would be Gouraud shading. And if we look or think in a shader context, that means we do the lighting computation in the vertex shader and compute the color with Phong, Torrent Sparrow, whatever. In the vertex shader, the resulting color becomes a varying, as output by the vertex shader, and then the rasterizer just interpolates this color. This gives us something smooth. It's maybe more efficient because we have usually much less vertices than we have pixels. So we only compute at the vertices. There's only one thing left now. And this is, we need a vertex and a normal per vertex. And we somehow have to define that. For flat shading, we could take the normal of the triangle. That's simple to compute, because a triangle is flat. But if we have normals per vertex, we have to think about how can we compute that. Because such a normal, if we have triangle meshes, looks like that. It has surrounding triangles, and each of these triangles has a normal on its own. And so what we have to compute is a normal for shading, and of course the simplest way, and what is always done if you don't know a better solution, is to interpolate. So we just take all the surrounding normals and interpolate them. Usually we can make that a little bit better by taking a weighted average that also looks at the size of the surrounding triangles. So the larger a surrounding triangle is, the more impact it has on that normal. And this gives us this formula here. And that can be rather quickly computed, that normal here, by using successive cross products of these surrounding vertices here. So to compute the normal here, we look at this fan of vertices around that normal, P0, P1, P2, P3, P4, and always for two successive, we compute the cross product and sum all that up and normalize it, and this gives a normal exactly with respect to that formula. That can be derived somehow, yeah, I won't detail on that, but that's a very efficient and simple way to compute a reasonable normal in a vertex, yeah? And with that normal, we can make a lighting computation and interpolate, and we get, nice results. I hope. So here we can see such results for a very simple scene. So you here see again the result with flat shading. Yeah, here the teapot is even worse subdivided. We see the single facets very easily, and with Gouraud shading, and also obviously things are more rounder now, but with Gouraud shading we get something much more smooth, but we will see that specular highlights still are a problem with Gouraud shading, and that can be rather easily explained. Let's look at this example here. Yeah, let's say we have such a highlight, yeah, you know, these little highlights on our glossy bunny, for instance, yeah. And now what happens is that this highlight moves while I move around the object or while I move the camera around, and at some point this highlight here hits a vertex, yeah. So what will happen, that vertex becomes very bright, and due to interpolation, yeah, this brightness is interpolated over the entire triangle. So even if that highlight is maybe only that size, yeah, it has an impact on the entire triangle, so it becomes much too big. And the other case is that this highlight is within a triangle, and then it's just lost, yeah, because none of the vertices has a highlight. The highlight would be here in between, and then it's lost. So as a result, yeah, we don't have a we don't have a highlight that moves smoothly. Yeah, but it pops up and is too bright, and then it disappears, and then it's too bright again, and it's just very not smooth in time. Yeah. And it's particular for glossy surfaces. So if we have diffuse surfaces, Gouraud shading is fine. Yeah, you will never see any artifacts from the fact that we just interpolate, but in particular for glossy surfaces, that won't be the case. An alternative is to do so-called Phong shading. Now, this is not to be mixed up with Phong lighting, although they are both very closely related. And the idea of Phong shading now is to say, okay, when I rasterize my triangle, I have normals at the vertices of my triangle. And now during rasterization, I first interpolate the normals, yeah? And the normals are passed to the fragment shader. The fragment shader gets the interpolated normal and then does the lighting computation. So again, in terms of shaders, yeah, the lighting computation now is done in the fragment shader. And the fragment shader in general is more often executed than the vertex shader. Yeah, so it's costly because the lighting, yeah, if you remember that with a Fresnel term, for instance, yeah, that's quite heavy. Yeah, so we have to do that then per pixel. But in general, the quality is much bigger or much higher. And de facto, it's the standard today to do that shading per pixel in the pixel shader. Yeah, and that's then called per pixel lighting. Yeah, so for every pixel, we do compute or make these lighting shading, lighting computations. And here we can see a result. So constant shading, flat shading, Gouraud shading, and now also Gouraud shading with specular highlights, yeah? And then we can also see these specular effects, but that's still Gouraud shading, yeah? So here you can see these highlights don't look very nice. Again, from the highlights, essentially we can see the triangle, so we can see the underlying structure, but if we take Phong shading, then the highlights get the shape that we want. Yeah, and even here, this torus is very badly subdivided, but we can still see a rather smooth shading here on this torus. Okay, and this is what we've also seen, or what we can also see in that demo that you cannot see again. Okay, now I cannot see. Okay, here we are. Good. Yeah, so again, here our bunny only diffuse. And now we apply Phong lighting with Guro shading. Yeah, and so if you look at these highlights now, yeah, maybe we even have to get a little bit closer. Here you can clearly see the single triangles, right? I hope you can. Yeah, and if we switch to Phong shading, Phong lighting and Phong shading, we get this here. Yeah, and we have, I mean, you can still see some effects here, but it's, I really have to zoom in to see that. Oops. from here, it looks very, very smooth. Yeah, in contrast. Yeah, I mean, from that distance, for that example, the difference is not too big, but it's still there. And what we can also see, if we here look at Guro shading, for instance, then obviously, here, the lighting computation happens in the vertex shader. Yeah, here you see the ambient, diffuse, specular part, the dot products, yeah, normal with light, reflection with light, and the power function. That happens here in the vertex shader. And for the Phong example, all that stuff happens here in the pixel shader. Yeah, ambient, diffuse, specular, and so on. And the normal is passed as a varying. Yeah, this is just here, the normal is computed and then passed as a varying to the fragment shader, which then does the lighting computation. And for the Guro case, the color is computed here in the vertex shader and then passed to the fragment shader as a varying. Yeah, and the fragment shader just takes the interpolated color. Okay. This direction it works. Good. So, are there any questions on this? No. Okay. Then we come to the real topic for today. A little bit late, but but in general, the idea is not difficult. Here we are. And this is texture mapping. Okay, the idea of texture mapping is the following. So up to now, and also in the example you've seen before, when we have that bunny object, this object has a uniform material all over. Yeah, the entire surface is a uniform material. But of course, that's not very realistic. Yeah, usually such an object has whatever dirt on it, marks from usage. It has maybe different materials on top and so forth. Yeah, so somehow we would like to be able to change our material parameters over the surface. And one possibility would be to store these parameters in the vertices of our triangle mesh and to interpolate them. But if we have a rather rough triangle structure, yeah, and then this is just not fine enough. Yeah, if we want to do something like this here, and this probably explains texture mapping pretty well, yeah, we want to render a wall, which is two triangles, yeah, but there's also here a painting on it or a wallpaper in that case, yeah, and now this image, this structure of the wallpaper, we would be able to apply, but we cannot use so small triangles, yeah, that this pattern here can be faithfully represented in the vertices, yeah, that would be an enormous waste, yeah. But on the other hand, we would just be able to take an arbitrary image and paste it onto our objects, yeah, and take that image to control material parameters. In the simplest case, the diffuse color, but maybe also the shininess or whatever. And this is texture mapping. And yeah, of course, it's a very widely used technique. Yeah, it's one of the first things that was used to make objects more visually more interesting. Yeah, instead of increasing geometry, we can just glue images onto them. Yeah, and so they immediately look much more interesting and appealing. Yeah, if we have things like this here, geometry is a simple square, but if we put the picture of a brick wall on it, yeah, it looks like a brick wall. Very simple. Yeah, and from a geometrical point of view, it's still a square. Or here another example, yeah, this T-Rex here, or this object here. In fact, the basic geometry is rather coarse, but all that detail, even these bumps here, yeah, they are all generated by textures. So textures are mapped that tell us yeah, that there is a bump here, so that's controlled by something which we call height maps and all that stuff, yeah, and also the color is not uniform, but it has bright places and dark places, and some parts are glossy, others are not. That's all controlled by textures. Yeah. Okay, and you see, yeah, they've been introduced in the 70s, yeah, so it is really very old. And now the question is, yeah, how can we do that? How can we apply textures to arbitrary geometry? And the problem is always the same. Essentially, we have a texture that's a 2D image, yeah, that can be like this here, generated on a computer, but it can also be a photograph or something like that, or come from a measurement. We have geometry in 3D, yeah, and we have a rule how to glue that image onto the geometry by using so-called texture coordinates. So that means, in that example, we have that quad, and each quad has additionally an attribute, which is the coordinate that describes which part of that texture should be mapped to that vertex. So in that case, the texture coordinate is 0, 0, so that part of the image should be glued here. Here it's 1, 0, so that part should be glued here. That one should be glued here, and that one here. And if we put that together, we get this image here. Yeah? And in that example now, it's just a kind of distorted original texture, yeah, distorted by the shape of that original facet. So that's texture mapping. Yeah, for a very simple case. Of course, in general, we will have triangles, yeah, and we won't have the entire texture, but only a small part, and so on. But that's the idea of texture mapping. Again, here, looking at these old images, yeah, here, the scene, the last state from the part before, with and without texture mapping. I mean, these images are something like 30 years old, so. yeah, but, I mean, typical example, also the floor here. Yeah, that's just essentially a picture of a real floor and then just mapped onto the object. And, yeah, so they get they look just like the original did. Okay, yeah, so what are textures for now? Yeah, we can say it's a 2D image that's mapped onto our 2D surfaces, but in general, textures can be much more. So sometimes it's not really an image, but it's a program that computes for a particular texture coordinate a value. So for instance, this checkerboard texture here, you don't really need an image describing that, but you could write a little program, yeah, that for a given texture coordinate just delivers whether you are in a white or in a black square and then generates black or white. Yeah, so that could also be done in a shader. Then it would be a procedural texture. Or a texture can be only 1D, for instance, if you want to visualize things like temperature on an object, yeah, and you want to visualize warm is red and cold is blue, yeah, then you can take a single texture coordinate per vertex, that is its temperature, yeah, and visualize then the temperature using a color from that 1D texture. Or textures can be 3D. Yeah, if you have tomography data from a CT scanner, for instance, yeah, that's 2D slice images through the human body or anybody, yeah, and if you stack them together, you have a three-dimensional texture of that object. Yeah, and different things. For now, we only look at 2D textures. Yeah, so, and the complicated cases usually can simply be derived from these. Okay, and also textures can contain anything, anything you wish. So if we have the Phong lighting model, we can apply a texture and use it, for instance, as the diffuse color, or we can use it as diffuse and specular color, or we can take a texture that only has one channel and take it as the shininess coefficient. Yeah, then the texture tells me there are parts of the surface that are very glossy, others are not. Yeah, or you can control the ambient color or other material parameters. Yeah, for Cook Torrens, there are many possibilities to use textures. And just this is a real world example. Yeah, so in the movies, objects that you see have usually 5 or 10 textures applied. Yeah. And these textures can contain, so we have rather coarse geometry, yeah, but textures contain things like shadows, yeah, self-shadowing of the objects, indirect light on the objects, displacement, that's these bumps that I spoke about, yeah, that are generated, also controlled by textures. Then also normals, that's also a nice way that you can fake much more complex geometry than there is in reality just by storing normals in a texture. Yeah, albedo is just the basic color, and these are really just a few examples. Often these objects have many textures applied all at once. Okay, good. Okay, but we always have the same problem, yeah, that we want to do that mapping of a 2D image onto our triangles, yeah. And here we always have, as we've seen in the image before, we always have the setup. Given is an image, a 2D image, yeah. For now, we assume it's square, or we parameterize it by the unit square from 0 to 1, yeah. And we have a triangle. And at the vertices of that triangle, we have texture coordinates. Yeah, and this texture coordinate, let's say, is here. This is here. And this is here. And now we have to take that content, yeah, and somehow map it here to this triangle in our frame buffer, yeah, or in our view. And maybe already here you can see some problems. Yeah, so here it a little bit looks like we are enlarging that original image. Yeah, so if the resolution here is not fine enough, here in the result we might see single pixels. In fact, there will also appear problems if we shrink images. This is what we will speak about next week. Then more. For now, let's only we only look at how can we compute that mapping now. Yeah, if we have here now a pixel that we rasterize, how can we find out where is that pixel here in that image so that we can take that color, yeah, and use it in our shader here. Yeah, how can we do that mapping? And to this end, yeah, we have texture coordinates assigned with our vertices. So our vertices now again have another attribute. Yeah, so we have the 3D position, we have the normal to do the lighting, and now we also have texture coordinates, and usually we call them S and T, or U and V. Yeah. Both are common. Yeah, so let's say for now we have texture coordinates S and T, and in fact, texture coordinates can even be four-dimensional, or can be homogeneous three-dimensional coordinates. That means have four components. We won't need that for now. For now, we only have just two texture coordinates, S and T. Yeah, for every vertex in our scene, we have this S and T. Yeah, and now how can we do that mapping? Yeah, or where do we get these texture coordinates from? Okay, that we first have to look at. Yeah, because let's say we want to take the bunny object. Yeah, so, or let's put it the other way around. Let's say we have that bunny object in real, yeah, and I give you a wallpaper, one roll, and I say, please apply that to the bunny. Yeah, obviously you will have a problem. Yeah, how can I wrap that bunny in my wallpaper? Yeah, it won't be possible without tearing the wallpaper. Yeah, so maybe you take a rubber version, yeah, which you can then apply. But at some time, yeah, you will have to stretch that that rubber sheet, yeah, and maybe it will tear at some places and so forth. And this is a problem that we call parametrization. It's a long-standing problem in computer graphics, essentially still unsolved. but there are cases for which it's very simple. So, for instance, if we have a cylinder, yeah, it's rather simple to take such a wallpaper here and apply it simply just by rolling it, yeah, around the cylinder. And this even works without stretching. Yeah, we can really make it with normal paper, and it's clear how this best, what the best solution is. Yeah. So if we do that, yeah, we can for every vertex here on our cylinder, we can rather easily compute the corresponding texture coordinate, yeah, so that we can take this wallpaper and wrap the cylinder with our wallpaper, yeah, so that we have texture coordinates between 0 and 1. We can easily apply these. The first texture coordinate is the angle around the main rotation axis. Somewhere we have to choose the 0, yeah, and then one texture coordinate is just how far are we around the cylinder, and the other texture coordinate is the height. Yeah. That's simple, but if we have something like this here, yeah, then it becomes more complicated. Or even if the cylinder would become a cone, yeah, that's already complicated. Yeah, and here, there's not a unique answer where we can say it's best, because it depends now on what do we define as best. Yeah, and yeah, so these. This is the task of parametrization methods. Yeah? So given an arbitrary surface, compute such a parametrization such that an image is mapped onto this object with as little deformation as possible. Yeah? Okay, I won't detail on that problem. If you're interested in such stuff, we have the lecture Geometry Processing. And their parametrization is one core part where we look at algorithms, how to do that. And if you use tools like Blender, for instance, or any modeling tools, they usually have functionality to compute such a parametrization. And if you use that, you will quickly see that it's very difficult to do that correctly. It quite often breaks and gives you unreasonable results. And then you have to subdivide geometry and do it separately on the different parts and so forth. So that can quickly become a difficult challenge. Okay, here again, yeah, this deformation thing. So ideally, what we want to have is that if we have an arbitrary triangle and we look at the corresponding triangle in the image, yeah, that is mapped to that triangle, that the shape or this triangle should be as similar as possible to that one. Yeah, and for the general case, that won't be possible. So there's a kind of optimum to search. Okay, here are other examples. Yeah, for instance, also for a face. Yeah, that's a very common problem. I want to apply a texture to a face. Yeah, how can I map that 3D surface to a 2D domain? Yeah, and here, obviously, They didn't even try to get a rectangular texture, because that would result in even more deformation. But we here get a non-rectangular image region, and it's also sometimes also called a flattening, because it really, this 3D object is flattened to a 2D surface, and in this space we can then define our texture and map it back to 3D, or go from 3D to 2D using our texture coordinates. The other examples for parametrizations, for different objects, and these parametrizations are displayed by such a checkerboard pattern, and we can see that the single fields, the single squares are still rather square, which shows that it's a good parametrization. And very often, parametrization, if you have an object like this here, then parametrizing the entire object is sort of hopeless, If you have just these arms and so on, that's just hopeless. So normally this parametrization is done in a manual process, or at least semi-manual, where the object is decomposed into single parts, for which there's more hope to find a parametrization, like for instance the legs, and the tail and the arms and the head, and then parametrization is computed for these independently, and all the resulting regions are merged to what we call a texture atlas. So here that would be one, and here you can see, for instance, this is part of a leg, this is the other leg, and so forth, and probably this is the head. This is one side of the head, this is the other side. These single parts are then puzzled together, and you see, nevertheless, there's still quite some space is wasted, and then we have a square texture, and every point here has its own region covered in that texture. And if we do more manual optimization, we can even end up with something like this here, where it's even that, for instance, the texture on this leg and on this leg can be chosen the same. It can be used for both legs. We don't need independent textures. They look the same. So we can reuse regions. And ideally, we have a texture atlas that looks like this. But this requires quite some effort. And a modeler has to spend a lot of time, not only to generate the 3D model, but also to have such a parametrization, such a wrapping. That's how it's called. Okay. So, that's a still unsolved problem, I would say, to do that automatically. But for now, let's assume we have that given. And we are at this step here. We have a single triangle or a simple object, and we want to apply such a texture here. And now many of you might say, okay, that's not really a problem. We have all the ingredients that we need. We have texture coordinates at the vertices. So S1, S2, S3, So what we can do is that we rasterize this image and we interpolate the texture coordinates as we learned. So for that point, I have an interpolated ST. And this texture coordinate I take, I look for the corresponding pixel, ST, read the color, and apply it here in my pixel shader. So we would just, it's very simple. Just take ST, make it a varying, the rasterizer interpolates, and we get an interpolated value, and we just look up in the texture the corresponding color. That does work, but there's one subtlety we have to consider, and that's the following. Let's look at this example. We have a square, and now we don't render, I told you, that normally we don't rasterize quadrilaterals, but triangles, So to rasterize that square, we have to subdivide it into two triangles. Here you see this red line. This shows us how we subdivide it. And if we now take that texture here, that grid, and apply it, we will get this result here. And you see this texture here, yeah, it is continuous, but here this line, yeah, has a dent here. Yeah, it's not straight. And it must be this way. It's a wrong result, yeah, but because we do linear interpolation, or what we learned is using barycentric coordinates and all that stuff, yeah. But that means that along this line, also we make a linear interpolation, yeah. And you see here these cells here, yeah. They are linear along this line, but this leads to this wrong result here. And this is what we want to have in the end. And this is what we get by this very simple linear interpolation trick. And again, of course, now that's a problem between affine mappings and projective mappings. Our linear interpolation, yeah, only, yeah, makes something linear, but obviously here we need something non-linear. And here we have the ratios here along this line. If we look at the intersections with the cells, these ratios are maintained. Maybe you remember from affine mappings, they maintain ratios. Yeah, so a center point also after the mapping remains the center point. And if we here look at the center point, that's this one. After this, the center point ends up here, which is no longer along, which is no longer the center of this line. Yeah, because it's a perspective is something projective. Yeah? So we have to rethink our interpolation here and probably have to do something more complicated. And so here we see it for a practical example. Yeah, if we take that checkerboard example, yeah, and we do the interpolation, the interpolation in the wrong way, then we get this result here, yeah, which is obviously wrong. And in particular, yeah, it shows how we subdivide it to triangles. If we would subdivide here, it would look different. Yeah, and we can really see the subdivision here. And yeah, if we make more extreme cases, the results become even worse. Yeah, and this is the correct result. And that can be solved. Yeah, and but I think it's an interesting thing to look at. And here comes an explanation and how we can maybe solve it. So let's look at this example here. So what do we see? We see a line segment in 3D space. Here's our camera. That's the image plane, yeah? And this is our camera, and this is a line segment in 3D, yeah? It could be like, yeah? So that would be the equivalent. I'm the camera, this is the image plane, this is the line segment, okay? Good. And now, on this line segment, we look at a point on the line segment. Here, to keep things simple, we just take the center point. Yeah, and we say, this line segment has a texture coordinate because it's only a line. We only have one texture coordinate, but it will simply transfer to two texture coordinates. So we have a texture coordinate, and here at the start, let's say it's 0, and at the end it's 1. So essentially, yeah, the texture coordinate spans this, spawns this line segment. And at position 0.5, we just have the center. Yeah, this is the center point between, on this line segment. And now we project it onto our image plane here. So the point at 1 ends up here, and the point 0 ends up here. And you see that the center point now ends up at a position which is not in the center anymore. Yeah, that's exactly this effect here, yeah, that here the center point of the line here in the image is mapped to here. It's no longer on the center. Yeah? And this is what we can exactly see here. Here it's the center, but in the image plane it's no longer the center point. Yeah? Okay, so interpolating texture coordinates. Yeah, so essentially we would have to interpolate the texture coordinates before projection into image space. Yeah, or we should not only interpolate texture coordinates in image space, but have to consider how the original object was in 3D space. Okay, and I mean, that's a very old problem. Yeah, it's very good understood. There's a derivation here. You can find the corresponding paper that does a derivation, how to do that entire thing completely. I will skip all the computing, math, algebra part, and only show the results essentially. So, how does that work? Yeah. So for that particular example, we can say our line looks like the following, or points on this line. Yeah, we can describe as follows. We say the starting point is x1, z1, and then we walk here to the endpoint x2, z2, and we do that by computing that vector from here to here, and then we take the starting point plus s times this vector. So that's exactly this formula here. Yeah. And for s equals 0, we get this point. For s equals 1, we get this point. And for s in between, yeah, we get all the points along this line. And now if we look at the projection, yeah, we can do essentially the same. The projected point is x1 over z1. Yeah, that's perspective, means divide by z. So we are on the z equals 1 plane. And this point is x2 over z2. Yeah, and the vector does this. And now the points in between are spawned by a texture coordinate S prime. Yeah, and this S prime obviously is different from this S. Yeah, so if we walk from here to here, S prime, that's the interpolation value that we would get by linear interpolation in screen space. Yeah, S prime is not the same as this S. Yeah, and we somehow have to find this mapping. If we interpolate in screen space, we have S prime, and we somehow have to convert it to the real S. Yeah, that also considers how this thing lies in space. And with some algebra, yeah, or some arithmetics, we get the following relation, that S can be described in this way. So S prime is the interpolated texture coordinate interpolated in screen space, and with that formula, yeah, we can convert it to the real S in world space, to the real texture coordinate. And you see, it depends on the depth at the start and at the end point. Yeah, so it depends on z1 and z2. And in fact, we can see if z1 equals z2, then it cancels out, and this entire thing becomes s equals s prime. Yeah, so if our object is like this, yes, parallel to the image plane, then we don't have a problem, but the less this is the case, the more we have a problem. Yeah, this is shown in this formula here. Okay, so this is good. Yeah, because this now gives us a direct relation. We can do linear interpolation in screen space, but then we have to this texture coordinate, yeah, we get S prime, and then we have to convert it to S, yeah, before we can look into our texture. Or so here would be an example that explains that. Yeah, so if we have here in this example, we have set equals 1/2. So here set is 1/2, and here set is 3/2. And if we apply these formulas, for instance, for a point that is at 0.75, 3/4, yeah, and we apply that formula, we find out that the real S is 1/2. Yeah, so for the example shown before, obviously the point at 1/2 here is mapped to 3/4. Yeah, so we can check that formula here. There's an even more elegant way to do that, not using that formula, but the idea now is the following, that instead of, or what we do in the end, the algorithm looks as follows. We have our triangle, and we want to interpolate our texture coordinates, yeah, or any other attribute. So let's for now say S. Yeah, so we have S1, S2, as 3, but it's also valid then for t, for the other texture coordinate, or for whatever. Yeah. And now instead of in, and furthermore, for each of these points, we know its set value. And in fact, that's the set value after normalization. Yeah, you know, it's not linearly dependent on the real distance. Yeah, it's really the set value that we get after normalization. It's the depth as it's written to the depth buffer. Yeah. Okay, so we know these values. Yeah, and now what we do is that all, or what happens is that all attributes that are to be interpolated are first of all subdivided by set, by the corresponding set value. Not subdivided, sorry, divided. Yeah? So instead of S3, we use S3 over set 3. And instead of S1, we use S1 over set 1. And now here, sorry, it cannot be the set value after normalization. Sorry, that was wrong. okay, no, it's the real set value. Sorry. Okay. Because otherwise, yeah, we would have the problem set can be null of zero after normalization, obviously. So it's the set value, the real distance, yeah, the set values as we see them here. Okay. Good. So, yeah, we subdivide all our attributes, yeah, by the corresponding set values. And additionally, we take as an additional attribute 1 over the set value. And in fact, we don't need the set values themselves anymore. Yeah, and then we interpolate these values. Yeah, so just before interpolation, we subdivide everything by the corresponding set value. So at this point, yeah, we get something like an interpolated value for S over set, and we get an interpolated value for 1 over set. Yeah? This is interpolated to give you this one. This is or these 3 are interpolated to give you that one. And now here, to get the real value for S, we just have to see, to divide these again. So S over set over 1 over set. Yeah, this cancels out set, and this gives us S. And this S now is correctly interpolated. This is exactly the S, this S here in world space. Yeah? And yeah, this makes things simpler, yeah, because we just have to divide our attributes by set and then do the normal interpolation as we are used to. And then we can do this division to get the real attributes. And in fact, now you might say, some of you might even see, yeah, that this division again, yeah, it sort of asks for using homogeneous coordinates, and this can all be very well integrated using homogeneous coordinates. And I told you in the beginning that these texture coordinates are all homogeneous. And in fact, all these computations can also be done internally using homogeneous coordinates. Yeah. Okay. This is just the, yeah, okay. Here again, we see how that works algorithmically. Yeah, we take our attributes S and T. Yeah. And now you can hear maybe already, yeah. We take S and T and divide them by the corresponding set value, and we take 1 over set B. Yeah, so you see that set B is a kind of, yeah, homogeneous fourth component, obviously. Yeah, and we take that one and that one, and we interpolate now these values after division. This gives us these, and then we again consider these as homogeneous coordinates. That means we divide by that, and then we get the real values for S and T. Yeah? Okay. Good. So that's doable and solvable. And if we use libraries like OpenGL or WebGL, in fact, we don't have to take care of that. In fact, all varyings are interpolated in this manner. Yeah. So when I said for interpolation during rasterization, yeah, we use barycentric coordinates, yeah, this in fact was wrong, or it was not completely the truth. Yeah, the default in WebGL is to do the interpolation perspectively in with a perspective, as we've seen here. So we can interpolate texture coordinates. Yeah, so we can exactly do that simple approach that we've seen before: assign texture coordinates at the vertices, use the interpolated texture coordinate to access the texture. This is in WebGL very simple. We can bind images to our shaders and read them at an arbitrary position. These are called sampler objects. And yeah, with these sampler objects, then it's very simple just to read out the color value of that texture at a particular point and apply it to our image. And yeah, for the example, I think we don't have enough time, but that's a good start then in the next lecture. And then we will also look at problems that appear with these textures. Yeah, what happens if we magnify textures? That's rather simple. Then we can start seeing the single pixels. But maybe even a larger problem, yeah, what happens if we make these textures smaller? Because then very weird artifacts appear, which also tell us a lot about signals and so on. And this is what we will look into next Monday. Thank you.